this week, an enzyme that bridges diabetes and cancer.
In a way, cancer and diabetes are opposite sides of the same coin.
Coming up, Lewis Cantley discusses how he found a kinase's role in insulin signaling and diabetes. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and you're listening to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. First this week, our staff writer Andrea Garleski wrote an article about a scientist's quest to find a treatment for MRSA. Andrea is with me here in the studio, and I want to ask you, first of all, give me a little background on what MRSA is.
Sure. Well, MRSA, M-R-S-A, stands for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. So it's basically general staph that is highly resistant to antibiotic treatment, and it's sort of taken the country by storm recently. There have been a number of fatal cases, so everyone's really up in arms about the superbug, as they call it. So this researcher, Naomi Balaban, has been studying staph in particular for over 15 years. And so her work is of high interest these days.
So tell me what she's actually trying to work on. In your article, you talk about sort of the signaling pathway in
sure.
the bacteria.
Well, she's identified the major molecular players in what leads to a severe staph infection. And what happens is, when the bacteria is in high concentration or out of equilibrium on a surface, and bacteria is found on any surface, living and not, it forms what's called a biofilm. That's very high concentration of the bacteria. And that biofilm starts producing toxins, and that's what makes it an infection and leads to the bacteria spreading. So in order for that to happen, a signaling pathway has to get activated. And so when the bacteria forms a biofilm, it produces a molecule called RAP, RNAi-3 activating protein. And that in turn activates another molecule called TRAP, and down the line until you produce the toxins. So Dr. Balaban has discovered that another protein actually inhibits this whole signaling pathway, and it's called RIP, R-I-P, for RNAi-3 inhibiting peptide. So she's known about RIP for a long time, and she's actually gone through animal studies and shown that RIP actively inhibits the toxin production of staph. And when I first met her up in Massachusetts, I had arrived at the perfect timing. They'd just gotten results showing that when you knock down the signaling pathway in not just staph, but in Bacillus cereus, another homologous bacteria, it worked the same way. So it was just added evidence to their arsenal of scientific findings that yes, this molecule is key to inhibiting the signaling pathway that produces toxin that leads to infection with staph.
So if RIP is the good guy and you want to sort of ramp that up in bacteria, or you want to apply it to bacteria, what would the therapy actually be to enhance
therapy they're doing is just, they've basically just injected it, or used topical solution, or injected it in test surgical cases with rats. A lot of times what happens in surgery is they're putting, you know, devices in the body in vivo, and those devices have bacteria on them, so where there's an open wound and foreign devices, that's a common place where infection can happen. So they've done experiments where, you know, they have a rat and they create a wound on the rat, and they actually inject tons of bacteria into the wound site, and then there's a control for that, and then they also inject another wounded rat with just straight antibiotics, and then with antibiotics in this RIP treatment, and they found that antibiotics in combination with RIP, the infection is virtually altogether eliminated, which is really remarkable. And they've also experimented on rats. They had a paper this year that showed that RIP and antibiotic combination was effective in treating MRSA as well.
Great. So do you know the timeline for trying it out in humans?
Dr. Balaban has licensed all her patents to a company called Centigen, and they're hoping on getting an IND by the end of next year in 08. So hopefully they'll be moving forward with getting it to market.
Great. And hopefully those bacteria won't become resistant to RIP in the meantime.
It's interesting, but this researcher thinks that it's unlikely that these bacteria will become resistant. Because you're deactivating a signaling pathway, you're not doing the same thing that an antibiotic does, which is basically just kill the bacteria. And bacteria come up with a whole host of ways defending themselves against antibiotics by creating a thicker protective lining around themselves, using lipopolysaccharide linings, and actually multiplying even faster, and that's where bacterial resistance comes from. So with RIP, you're actually not even dealing with those host of defenses that the bacteria puts up. You're actually completely knocking out a signaling pathway so they can't produce toxins in the first place. So there's actually a small chance, likely, that they would develop resistance in the first place.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Andrea's article on thescientist.com, and it will also appear in the January issue of The Scientist. Next up, PI3 kinase. Harvard researcher Lewis Cantley discovered the enzyme in the 1980s and then showed how it's involved in cancer. Cantley writes about his discoveries in the December issue of The Scientist. Something he didn't write about much was that he also found that the kinase is involved in insulin signaling, and he eventually also linked it to diabetes. I spoke with him recently about how he made all these biochemical connections.
So back in the 70s, my lab was looking at insulin, and we had noticed that, in fact, it had been reported before us, that one of the things that insulin does is affect the activity of the plasma membrane sodium potassium ATPase. And I've been working on that enzyme, and so the question I was asking is, how might that work? And so, as I discussed in the article that I wrote, it was a process of pursuing reconstituting sodium potassium ATPase. We noticed that its activity depended on phospholinositides. And so it occurred to me that maybe insulin was somehow regulating the phosphorylation of that lipid. So when we finally found the connection to PI3 kinase, that growth factors activating PI3 kinase, we went back to ask again whether the insulin receptor might be doing the same thing. And found, in fact, that it did. Published that, I think, it was probably 91 or 92, in a paper in PNAS, that insulin could activate PI3 kinase. And that then raised the issue of whether events downstream of insulin were in general affected by PI3 kinase. And it took a while to figure that out. When the drug Wardmanin came along, that was found to inhibit PI3 kinase, it was then possible for us and other labs to add Wardmanin to cells and ask, does that affect insulin's downstream responses? And I should say, at this time, insulin, as you know, insulin was discovered back in the 1920s. It was a major breakthrough in understanding diabetes. And it was known that insulin did a lot of things, stimulate glucose uptake in the cells, stimulate changes in ion transport, protein synthesis, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a black box. You add insulin to the cell, all these things happen within minutes. Suppression of glucose, gluconeogenesis in the liver, et cetera. But it was a complete black box. No one had any idea how insulin did any of these things. And then the breakthrough came in the 80s. Late 70s, early 80s, with the purification of the insulin receptor, the discovery that it had an intrinsic tyrosine kinase. And then the question was, well, what does it do? What does the tyrosine kinase do? And so when we found the PI3 kinase, we thought, well, maybe this is it. This is the answer to what insulin does, that the tyrosine kinase activates the PI3 kinase. And that, in fact, turned out to be the case, but it didn't necessarily mean the PI3 kinase was mediating all these other downstream responses, like glucose uptake and protein synthesis and so forth. So, however, once we made that connection, many labs that have been working on insulin signaling for many, many years took off with that observation, began interrogating whether PI3 kinase was important for all these other events. And it turns out that virtually everything that insulin does is mediated through PI3 kinase.
Can you talk about what some of those things are then downstream?
Well, the critical thing, and in fact, the pathway that had really been a major, it still is a major focus, it's still not completely understood, is how does insulin stimulate glucose uptake? So this is a very fundamental, it's the main thing that insulin does to lower serum glucose. Glucose levels go up after eating a meal. You drink a Coca-Cola, glucose level goes in your blood in minutes. You have a high level of glucose that goes to the pancreas, stimulates insulin release. Insulin then goes to muscle, fat, and liver. In the case of muscle and the fat, it stimulates glucose uptake. So you clear glucose out of the blood, glucose levels come back down, and at the same time, the muscle gets glucose as an energy source to allow muscle contraction. The fat takes glucose up in and stores it, converts it into triglycerides. So you have a storage for the time when you don't have food. And in the case of the liver, the insulin is not stimulating glucose uptake, but rather suppression of continued glucose production. The consequence of all three of those events is that serum glucose levels come back down and maintain homeostasis. That fails to work properly. You get elevated glucose, that can ultimately cause major problems. So that's been, you know, the holy grail of the field is to figure out, well, how does insulin stimulate glucose uptake? And it became clear, even in the mid-90s, that PI3 kinase was required for that. First from drug effects with Wortmannin, and then later through knockouts of components of the pathway. I should say as a diversion here, we got a surprise when we first started knocking out genes for PI3 kinase because we were knocking out the regulatory subunit rather than the catalytic subunit because of the complexity that catalytic subunit knockouts were embryonic lethal. But as we began to knock out the regulatory subunits, we initially found that rather than suppressing glucose uptake, that when we knocked out regulatory subunits of PI3 kinase, we actually enhanced glucose uptake into muscle.
How do you interpret that?
Well, it turns out to be rather complicated, but we think we understand it in some detail now. We've had published about 4 papers on this in the last 6 or 7 years. And it turns out the regulatory subunit, even though it's needed for the catalytic subunit to be activated, in some tissues, it's in excess over the catalytic subunit. And when you, in the excess of 85 over 110, actually suppress, the regulatory over the catalytic actually suppresses the ability of the catalytic to be functional. And it, there are probably several ways in which this happens, but in part, it ties up the activators of PI3 kinase, the IRS1 protein, in a way that can no longer turn on PI3 kinase. And this is probably a built-in homeostatic mechanism to ensure that the insulin response occurs rapidly but does not overshoot. If you take too much glucose out of the blood, then you'll actually pass out. So your brain has to have a continual supply of glucose, very short deprivation of glucose. Brain's in trouble. So these tissues that respond to insulin to clear glucose have to be very well maintained to ensure you don't get an overshoot. So we think the ratio of the regulatory to catalytic subunit sets that sensitivity ratio and ensures that you don't get an overshoot. So anyway, that's a side issue that was rather confounding, but it's in spite of that, it became very clear that if you completely lose PI3 kinase in tissues like liver, muscle, you almost completely block or do completely block glucose uptake into the muscle. You suppress the ability of insulin to, eliminate the ability of insulin to suppress gluconeogenesis in the liver.
And in terms I was going to ask, in terms of then looking at diabetes, then how is that involved?
So, type 2 diabetes is still a mystery. Of course, type 1 diabetes, we understand that, you know, at some fundamental level that's due to destruction of the islet cells in the pancreas. And that the reason the islet cells are destroyed is still not completely clear. The immune system is involved. This is the white immune system attacks the islet cells and destroys them. It's still not completely clear. Type 2 diabetes is even more complicated and probably has a number of mechanisms by which it occurs. There's some evidence that one form of insulin resistance, what's called gestational insulin resistance or gestational diabetes, does seem to involve the mechanism that I just described. And what is found is that placental growth hormone, which is produced when the woman is pregnant, ends up causing an overexpression of the regulatory subunit of PI3 kinase, and that suppresses the ability of insulin to stimulate glucose uptake into muscle. And we've shown that in collaborations with other labs, shown that if you decrease the amount of regulatory subunit in a mouse, then you eliminate the ability of the placental growth hormone press insulin and glucose uptake.
Do you have any sense whether this might also be related to the type 2 diabetes that is associated with obesity and diet?
It's possible. It's possible. There is some evidence that in type 2 diabetics that there's in other non-gestational types of type 2 diabetes, that there's also a distorted ratio of 85:110 regulatory to catalytic subunit of PI3 kinase. But how that happens, we don't know, and whether it's still not enough data to say whether that's a minor subset or whether it's a significant fraction of diabetes, or even why it causes this, or even why this should occur.
And what are some of the...
And the link, and I should say the link to obesity is still not clear either. There's a lot of data, again, our lab hasn't pursued this direction, coming from other laboratories, that the immune system, again, is involved. And that as you have obesity, particularly with visceral obesity, where the fat is in the gut area, this can stimulate macrophage invasion, oxidative stress, signals of the kind cytokines that result from that type of crosstalk may be exacerbating this insulin resistance problem. But this is an area that my lab hasn't really gotten involved in.
What are you pursuing right now along these lines?
In the area of insulin, we're still interested in the mechanism by which PI3 kinase regulates glucose uptake. We don't really understand that completely yet. The mechanism involves GLUT4 vesicles that pre-exist in the muscle or fat moving from an intracellular location to the plasma membrane where they can take up the glucose. So we understand most of that, but there's still a few events there that biochemical levels that really aren't completely clear, so we're still looking into how that might occur. The enzyme AKT, also called protein kinase B, that is directly activated by lipid products of PI3 kinase, is clearly playing a critical role in the glucose uptake and the recruitment of GLUT4 to the plasma membrane. But there's at least one substrate of AKT that seems to be involved in this, but we think there may be more going on that still needs to be understood. There are other issues, such as why different isoforms of AKT are preferentially involved, that aren't really understood. So this black box of BRAF insulin to muscle and suddenly glucose goes up has been mostly unveiled, but there are many aspects that we still don't really completely understand. We also are pursuing an unusual connection that came about from another mouse knockout that we did several years ago that reveals yet another PI kinase pathway in insulin sensitivity, regulation of insulin sensitivity. enzyme we discovered 10 years ago is carrying out a reaction not known to exist prior to that, the conversion of phosphatidylinositol 5-phosphate to phosphatidylinositol 4,5-bisphosphate. And before that discovery, phosphatidylinositol 5-phosphate wasn't even known to exist. So this is, we've been trying to understand what this other pathway is doing. And we generated a mouse in which one of the genes for that pathway was deleted in the mouse. And the consequence was the mouse had less tendency to develop obesity. And secondly, it maintained increased insulin sensitivity compared to wild-type mice, even in a high-fat diet.
Hmm.
So that, when we look more carefully into what that enzyme does, we found that when we deleted the gene for it, that we got increased AKT activation or prolonged AKT activation in response to insulin. And we've been able to show that in the mouse itself, particularly in muscle, but also in mouse embryo fibroblasts that we generate from knockout mice, that the ability to maintain AKT in an activated state is prolonged. So this is, we really don't know what the biochemical connection is. Why does this particular lipid phosphorylation somehow affect the ability of AKT to be maintained in a highly phosphorylated state? So that's a big mystery, how important that is in controlling insulin sensitivity and normal physiological states and or diabetes. Not clear. It's an opportune target, though, for pharmaceutical intervention because it is a druggable enzyme, which we'd predict if you could inhibit would result in increased insulin sensitivity.
So for these animals who no longer have the enzyme, it's been knocked out in them, aside from that change, then, is there any other phenotype?
They have, they're smaller.
Uh-huh.
As I say, they have less adiposity and somewhat lower bone density. But other than that, they live a normal lifespan. They look normal.
Hmm. And cognitively?
You mean, are there any brain dysfunctions?
That's right.
None in the single knockout. Now, we're beginning to do... Well, there are three genes for this, and all three genes are highly expressed in the brain, in addition to differential expression in other tissues. So, yeah, as we began to do multiple knockouts, we're seeing some brain abnormalities. The single knockouts, however, don't give us any phenotype, any obvious phenotype in the brain.
And so a lot of your work has been on cancer, so what are you working on to link then the problems that PI3 kinase can cause in both diabetes and cancer?
So the fact that insulin stimulates a growth factor receptor that has similarities to other growth factor receptors, tyrosine kinase type growth factor receptors like IGF-1 receptor, PDGF receptor, etc., has raised the, and since these latter enzymes are known to play roles in cancer, this raises the question of, are we going to look, what we've learned about insulin signaling and control of diabetes relevant for addressing issues in cancer or vice versa? Obviously, the PI3 kinase pathway has played a critical role in both. You need insulin activation of PI3 kinase to get glucose clearance from the blood and control of glucose homeostasis. In contrast, if you have too much PI3 in a particular tissue, you end up with a cancer. So, in a way, cancer and diabetes are opposite coins, opposite sides of the same coin. And so the question is, as we elucidate the network that's involved in PI3 kinase signaling to maintain control of metabolism, does that inform us about what we should be thinking about in control of metabolism? exacerbate diabetes. And that is true for direct inhibitors of PI3 kinase. But as we further understand the network, it's becoming clear that other components of the network, the same drugs that affect those components, could be useful in both diseases. And the one compound that comes to mind here is metformin. Plays a role in suppressing gluconeogenesis in the liver. And by activating AMP kinase indirectly, and our work in cancer suggests that that same drug could also be useful in treating cancers by activating AMP kinase, which we know will suppress the mTOR-dependent signaling pathway, as well as many other pathways that are required for cell growth. So I think that that might be just the tip of the iceberg as we begin to explore further into how metabolism is controlled by growth factor receptor tyrosine kinases, that there are going to be many opportunities like this that will emerge.
That was Harvard's Lewis Cantley talking with me about his discoveries in diabetes, cancer, and the phosphatidyl inositol kinase, PI3K. Check out the December issue of The Scientist for more on Cantley's discoveries in cancer, or you can read it online at thescientist.com. While you're there, find out the winners of our Best Laboratory Website Awards and keep up to date with The Scientist's daily news blogs. That's all for our podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.